Well, okay, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Michael Tillinger. You've heard what we've been talking about, and that'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. And Michael, first of all, where can we get your books, Adam's Calendar, Slave Species of God, and Temples of the African Gods?
George, you can get them in the stores in the United States. They should be at the major stores, Borders and Barnes & Noble and so forth. If they're not, please ask for them. Get them to order it. Otherwise, also on Amazon. Yeah, they should be available pretty easily.
All right, very good. And what's new for you then? What are you going to do beyond this?
Well, I'm working on my new book now. Well, at the moment, I'm on a tour of the United States, as you may be aware of it. It's my second tour of the USA. We did one last year, and we had to come back and carry on because there was just such an amazing response. Moving through California, we just did a presentation this evening in Sacramento. Moving on to Salt Lake City and then further north up into California and, sorry, into the other states, Oregon, Washington, Portland, and Seattle, and then into Canada, into Vancouver, and then across back towards the East Coast. If you want to find out more about that, just go onto my website, which is ZuluPlanet.com or SlaveSpecies.com. And click on the USA tour banner, and it'll give you all the venues that I'm still going to be visiting and talking at. Otherwise, for those people that can log on to, just log on to directly onto my michaeltillinger.blogspot.com, and it'll give you the full schedule of all my tour venues.
Right. And Michael, how did you get involved in all of this in the first place?
Well, you know, George, like I guess everybody else with an inquiring mind, we all go through these same things, right? One day you wake up and you go, hold on, this whole history of humanity and the world just doesn't make any sense. And you start to explore and you start reading books. And the more you read, the more it opens up your mind and you want to know more and more and more. And eventually you end up with all this knowledge and information. And you start going, okay, what am I going to do with all this knowledge and information? And I decided to sit down and write a book about it, mainly because I was frustrated with people's negative reaction to Zachariah Sitchin and his books. And I thought, hold on, this guy has, he's devoted his life. He's given us probably more information and knowledge than any other one individual into especially the Sumerians and the translations and from that perspective. And I felt it was important to combine all that information and that knowledge and put it into a book that was easier to read than Sitchin, because a lot of his books have been described as being really a hard read and a difficult read, and a lot of people don't want to read it because it's too hard to read. So I pulled it together and I added, anatomy and religion to it and genetics and so forth, and presented a platform of which I believe, well, in Slave Species of God, my first book. And the response to Slave Species of God has just been so overwhelming that it still blows my mind that people are finding it now, 6 years after I released it, and it's just getting more and more popular. It blows my mind, And then I accidentally meet a guy called Johan Heiner, who has been photographing the stone ruins in South Africa for 20 years, and no one wants to listen to the guy. And he meets me, and he says, listen, let me show you these amazing stone circles we got here in South Africa. And the moment I saw those first photographs, I went, hold on, this is directly linked to what I've been writing about in Slave Species of God. And I started this process of investigation and research with Johan initially and then on my own. And then, 4 years later, here we are with remarkable, startling discoveries that point us towards the origins of humankind, evidence, physical evidence of what Sitchin has been writing about, the presence of Anunnaki on planet Earth, vast vanished civilizations, gold mining operations beyond our wildest imaginations, and here we are. So I'm working on my next book. After this American tour, I'll hopefully sit down and finish my next book, which will be called The Lost City of Enki, presenting pretty much everything that we've been talking about on this in this interview and what I present in my presentations and on this tour as well.
That's great. Let's go to the phones now. We'll pick it up by going to Victoria in Junction City, Oregon. Hi, Victoria.
Excuse me. Hi, George. Sure. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I just like to say I really appreciate your show, and you have some really good programs, and you don't know how many nights you've kept me company.
Well, perfect.
Anyway, I just wanted to ask him exactly what... You know, I hear this this term a lot, Anunnaki, and I'm not really sure what that is. That an ET, or that's one of my questions. And just I'm wondering if he thinks that some of these are living underground, as I've heard sometimes on your. Haven't I heard that on your program?
Yes, you have.
I thought so. I thought I had it. And I thought, oh, that's so.
They're
creepy.
Everywhere.
That's creepy, you know, but that's basically what I wanted
okay.
to ask
Mike, let's let you explain the Anunnaki.
Anunnaki, thanks for the question. Thanks very much. Appreciate it. The Anunnaki are these group of beings that are referred to in the Sumerian tablets. And if you look at my book, Slave Species of God, you'll get a lot more information about that. And also, obviously, a lot more information in Zachariah Sitchin's work. The Sumerian tablets refer to these groups of beings called the Anunnaki that arrived on Earth sometime in the past. And they arrived here for a specific reason. They were looking for gold. And they found gold in large amounts. And therefore, they established this vast mining operation to get the gold out of the ground. It seems that at first, these Anunnaki were getting the gold out of the water. And that becomes a whole different, very exciting and interesting debate, because that gets gold out of the water in a slightly different form, different fashion. And that's why I believe that they weren't after just the gold. They were all the shiny metallic gold, but they were also after the gold in its monoatomic form, because that's how it is invisible in water. And that's why we don't know that it's there. And this is what David Hudson has had such a problem with all these years, trying to prove something exists when you can't measure it, where the realms of science today does not have the capacity to measure something that you see appear and disappear in front of your eyes. But I'm digressing a bit. The Anunnaki ETs that arrived here, according to Zachariah Sitchin's calculations, around 430,000 years ago, started the gold mining operations, needed help, created the humans as a slave species, and here we are. We've evolved, we've grown in consciousness, and we are now contemplating our own origins and figuring this all out, because we've been kept in the dark.
Okay, next up, let's go to Rod Dial. Here he is in Tallahassee. Hi there.
Greetings. How you doing, George?
Good, Rod Dial.
How about yourself, Michael?
Excellent. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you as well. Yes, I was trying to, I have been doing a lot of research with the Holy Bible, the Judeo-Christian Bible, speaking about the Garden of Eden, where there is gold, and the gold of that land is good, and there's bdellium and onyx stones. And one of the rivers was called Pison, and the other was called Gihon, which compasses the whole land of Ethiopia. So I'm looking at a map, and the river, the Blue Nile, is the river that goes into Ethiopia, and the Nile River comes out of the Caribbean, out of North Egypt down into Egypt, all the way down into Sudan, is Enki a counterpart Set, and is Osiris counterpart Enlil, and the wars between Enlil and Enki, and which result in the war between Set and Horus. To make a long story short, when Cain was expelled from Egypt or from Africa, he went into the Mesopotamian region, and he shared that information with the Sumerians and the Babylonians, as for Nimrod was able to build a tower, a ziggurat pyramid. I'm trying to combine.
Okay, well, hold on for a second here. Let's see what he's trying to say, Michael. What do you think?
Well, I'm not quite sure what the question is. Could you give me a one-sentence question here?
It's more of a little history lesson of what's going on in Egypt. Egypt was way after the Sumerians, way after. But they kept some of this knowledge, didn't they?
Yeah. You know, like I said earlier in our discussion, is that everything you see in Egypt and in Sumeria is predated by, you know, more than 200,000 years with the activity in southern Africa. And that's the big hurdle a lot of people have to cross. Because, you know, until recently, I've come up with this, with the conclusions that I've made, those kind of numbers were just unthinkable, that there were humans, you know, anatomically advanced humans using advanced technology in gold mining operations somewhere on Earth, because we always shown that the early humans were, they were just like wild animals, and they were, you know, they weren't capable of doing anything. And when they talk about the exodus from Africa, they talk about exodus of almost like Neanderthal kind of man out of Africa, but that's not the case. And this is why I think the whole story of Southern Africa, the mystery of Southern Africa, the history of Southern Africa is one of the greatest, if not the greatest, mysteries in all of human history, because so little is known about it.
Well, that's true. Let's go to Rick, New York, New York, first-time caller. Hey, Rick, welcome.
Hey, how you doing? And I'm really enjoying your guests and your show. Can I just interject something? It would seem plausible to me that, you know, this country has only been here for 235 years, and look how far we've come technologically. So you put billions of years there. I'm sure societies have come and gone and come and gone. And if the survivors of those, you know, those places were not technologically, you know, astute, then it's lost. You know, it's lost. So why, even without the extraterrestrial component, it would seem that humans alone could come to those milestones, you know? And what's your opinion?
Well, I guess you're right. Humans probably could come to those milestones, but all the evidence seems to point that they reached those milestones with help from ETs. They're not only help from ETs, but, you know, were created by the ETs. And this is the one of the other things. This is not our planet. We, you know, we look at ourselves as human beings and saying, oh, this is our planet and so forth. But that's not what the evidence suggests. The evidence suggests that we're the byproduct on this planet. The planet belongs to much more advanced beings that come from other planets and other star systems that came here and inhabited this planet. The planet belongs to them. They created us as their slaves, but the slaves have woken up, and they have grown in consciousness. And this is the crucial thing, that the research that I'm involved in, if you do not embrace all areas of knowledge and research, and I'm talking about every possible thing that you can study, from history, archaeology, astronomy, physics, chemistry, quantum physics, metaphysics, the paranormal. If you cut anything out from your research, you will miss a big chunk of the puzzle. So what I'm talking about here seems to be, well, for me, it's important to be able to pull it together and be able to explain from scientific principles how this story has unfolded and present scientific evidence for that. And I hope I do that tonight on this radio show. It's been challenging to cover some of these things because we're talking about it, not presenting it with visual support material, and we're digressing because it's an exciting dynamic forum, right? But in my presentation, I take you on a journey of discovery where I present a lot of this evidence so that, you know, you walk away going, oh my God, the evidence exists that we have been cloned as a species. There is no more question about that. And I think George has done probably more interviews about this than anyone else to support that kind of thinking.
With all this that has happened, have you studied Atlantis yet, Michael?
That is the one area that I'm probably more vague on than anything else. What I can tell you, however, and this is phenomenal, this is when these little moments, these little aha moments of bright lights going on, I had an experience like this. I remember I mentioned to you earlier that I found what the Sumerian tablets, when they refer to Enki in his abode in the Abzu and where he constructed the earth splitter with which to carve the earth open and extract the golden veins. Well, when I found what I think is the earth splitter that in many ways mimics the what's known in electronics as the magnetron, which generates high, huge amounts of energy. So here we've got this huge stone-shaped magnetron that's like 30 meters in diameter, capable of generating insane amounts of energy that we can't even comprehend. When I showed this image of this magnetron stone ruin to this one psychic lady in Johannesburg, South Africa, before I figured out that these were energy devices, I showed her the photograph in my book, and within 2 or 3 seconds, it was like a knee-jerk reaction from her. She just blurted out, she said, "Oh my God, this is the device that caused the destruction of Atlantis."
That's pretty remarkable.
And that is amazing, because if you follow the work of Dramvelo Melchizedek and many others, they will tell you that Atlantis was destroyed due to experiments with energy, trying to generate insane or huge amounts of energy that somehow went out of control. And I believe that this psychic lady just pointed out the device that they used and that they were probably messing with. Because if they were using it in South Africa for the extraction and processing of gold, and probably also transmutation of gold from, you know, the diatomic to the monoatomic gold, the manna from heaven, and so forth, they would have then used those devices thousands of years later in Atlantis as well, or at the same time in Atlantis already.
Remarkable work, Michael. Anybody else doing this beyond you and Johan?
Well, you know, at this stage, it's really just me. Even Johan, you know, he's got a large company to run, so he's got his hands full. So at this stage, it's up to me. So I believe I've been blessed with this information and being given this knowledge for a reason. You know, and your audience knows, these things don't happen by accident. There's a much higher guidance that I guess we are led by. And I've been blessed with this information, with this knowledge, and it's my duty to take it to the world and to try and decode it to the best of my ability and continue. So this is what I'm doing, and this is why I'm back in the USA and sharing this information, because I truly believe that because of the large volume of enlightened beings in the USA, the shift will probably be driven from within the United States. I mean, and I'm referred by the shift, I mean the consciousness shift that is very, very close.
It may very well happen that way. Stay with us. Michael Tellinger will come right back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM with final phone calls. And our final segment, of course, with our guest Michael Tellinger right here on Coast to Coast AM. On our next program, Melvin Morris joins us as we talk about mind-body healing and other paranormal abilities. And we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, tell us a little bit more exactly where you believe Abzu is.
The Abzu is basically southern Africa. It would be South Africa, Zimbabwe, Botswana. The reason I say this is because this is where two of the most sacred sites are located, according to southern African shaman. Specifically Crater Mutwa himself, the preeminent South African shaman, the serpent worship site of Tsodilo Hills in northern Botswana, which is called the creation cave of the human race, and then Adam's calendar or Enki's calendar, where it is said heaven mated with Mother Earth, and it is also undoubtedly where all the gold in the world has come, where most of the gold in the world has come from. We have physical evidence of more than 10 million ancient stone ruins that have been destroyed by what seems to be a giant, you know, large volume of water covered by sand and deposits and soot and so forth. And then the millions of gold mines the evidence of the millions of gold mines that have been destroyed. So the Abzu, every time we read about the Abzu and the Sumerian tablets and the translations, I think we have now found where that is, and we can say with confidence that we're dealing and we're talking about Southern Africa. And that also solves the big riddle and the big question about where King Solomon's mines were. And there's a huge amount of information on that as well when you start talking about the period of King Solomon, about 1000 BC, and what's been happening in Southern Africa in the kingdom of Mono Motapa, the African golden kings that had all the gold mines in Southern Africa. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, George, that some Portuguese maps refer to that part of the world, and hold on to your hat, not as Mono Motapa, but also as Mana Motapa. And this thing starts to get more and more interesting.
It sure does. And ironically, I was just talking about gold at $5,000 an ounce one day. And, you know, here we are talking about these vast gold mines.
Yep.
If they only knew, gold wouldn't be worth nearly that, would it?
Exactly. And it's not about the value of gold we perceive it today. I mean, you know that, your listeners probably know this. It's all smoke and mirrors and deception. You know, the way that gold is. Remember that all ancient cultures constantly repeat the same thing. The gold belongs to the gods. It does not belong to humans. It's not our gold. It belongs to the gods. And so after, you know, 270,000 years, the flood comes and wipes everything out. They restart the civilization with vigor after the flood because they want more gold. There's now a huge obsession with gold. They seem to need more of it. And it's at that point that you see the speeding up of civilization and the sudden emergence of civilizations all over the world and more gold mining around the world. I believe the Olmecs, rise to prominence at that stage as well, some 12,000 years ago. I think they go back a lot further than people realize. And they seem to have very interesting links in their features to the African tribes of Africa. And they were expert gold miners and expert miners. And it's after the flood that you see the sudden rise of civilizations, and obviously the most important and prominent one were the Sumerians. But I also believe that it's with the Sumerians that the control of the human race really started to become effective and visible, and the divisions of the human race started to kick in, dividing people, the Tower of Babel incident. You know, imagine if everybody spoke the same language, how powerful we would be as a species, where we could communicate and understand each other. But if you want to control people, the best way is to divide them on every possible level you can. And that's, we see, definitely show the symptoms of this huge division. We're a deeply divided species that suffers deeply from this division on every possible level.
All right, back to the phones we go. Charles, Berkeley, California, and it's his turn. Hi, Charles, go ahead.
So much for having Michael back on the air. I've studied his work very carefully. I mean, he scrutinized it with technical precision, and his work is really spectacular. So, and we've exchanged emails quite a bit. So I want to ask on the air, when the human genome was decoded, one of the great discoveries was that the last major significant change in our neurophysiology occurred about 100,000 years ago. In other words, there was a big spike, some kind of mutational event occurred where we really split off from the other hominids of that time, and we became the Homo sapiens that we know of now. Now, when I asked Michael in the air, have you looked at or compared this genealogical information? Have you studied the timelines, let's say, of human mutation versus the timeline of your Adam's calendar and the work you've been sort of revealing in this context?
I've looked at some of them, but I think new information seems to be coming out all the time. But I think we've got to be careful also and studying and just pronouncing with absolute confidence what some of these mutations may be, because I don't think that we fully understand what the human genome is actually all about.
I would agree with you, and I've talked to Craig Venter several times, who was the founder of Celera, and of course he was the privatized version of the Human Genome Project. So the last time I talked to him was at the Molecular Medicine Conference about 2 years ago, and I looked him square in the eye and I said, look, something happened 100,000 years ago that nobody can seem to explain. What's your take on this? And he looked at it very carefully and said, we don't know. Yeah, it's mysterious. We have no idea. But the point is, the timeline matches almost exactly the timeline that you describe in your research. And so I just thought you might have some additional thoughts about that.
Well, and this is, these are the genetic aspect of this research is very critical, because it, as you say, it does bring to the surface some critical scientific arguments, but at the same time, there's so much, I don't want to use the word disinformation, but information that is transient, and what we think we know today is going to change tomorrow and so forth. So I'm a bit worried about that, because, you know, we read, if you look at how the exodus from Africa has been presented over the last 30 or 40 years, right? It started out 50,000 years ago, then it became 55, then 60,000 years ago, then it's 70,000. And they keep changing the timeline as to when the exodus from Africa happened. And based on whatever evidence or circumstantial evidence we get. And that is, for me, in a way, also indicative of how archaeologists analyze ancient ruins based on pottery fragments and bone fragments. You know, they're not really going to tell you much. You need to look at other scientific indicators surrounding those, because civilizations build on top of each other, and you're not going to extract information from finding pottery fragments. But to come back to the genetic stuff, the information we discover, the knowledge we're getting about DNA these days is so spectacular that how we think DNA shaped us is probably not the way that it happened. And I say this because there's some spectacular new information coming out from geneticists writing PhDs on this issue that talk about light activating our DNA and activating what they refer to as 22 chakras in our DNA. And what this tells us is that it comes back to this quantum soup of possibility and the sacred geometry of the nature of reality, that as much as physicists and mathematicians need to take cognizance of this research, so do geneticists, because it ultimately comes back to the same source. All things come out of unity, and out of this unity and the laws of nature, that all things in the universe, including our bodies, are formed according to those principles, and our DNA is just one of those things. And the fact that they talk about 22 chakras that are activated by specific frequencies of light fall perfectly into our understanding of sacred geometry. And the brilliant Willem de Swart, who I'm working in Johannesburg on the book called Secret Numbers of God, all this information is decoded, and when you finally, hopefully, get to read this book, Secret Numbers of God, it is truly phenomenal. It decodes the entire, what we call the numeric grid of this projected reality we call the universe, and allows us to understand these things. So the genetic aspect of our species is a complicated one, but in the end, I think we're going to find, and the evidence is already pointing to that, that the DNA is not really what we think it is.
Good point. Let's go to Chloe, Manhattan, New York. Hi, Chloe. Go ahead.
Thanks so much for taking my call. I'll try to be really quick here. I know you have other callers waiting. I just had a couple questions. Okay, the first being, what about animals, like, you know, squirrels, chipmunks? I mean, if ETs came to create us as slaves, certainly animals can't be slaves. So where did they come from? The other question is, what about the scientific notion that bacteria itself creates life forms? You know, what about that? And I'm also wondering why ETs would want gold. And the last question is, what about life after death? Does this suggest that there is no life after death. And great show. I'll take my answers off the air.
Okay. Well, this was a planet with an abundance of life, Michael, from the get-go.
Absolutely.
So the animals were everywhere.
Yeah. Remember, we've got to draw a distinction here between we're not dispelling the concept of evolution at all and abundance of life. Of course bacteria mutate and create life. Of course, that is known very well. But the other important thing, we get back to the source of light, the source of things. The ancient cultures talk about the galactic center as the great sun, and from the great sun comes all source of life. Well, we can now prove it. There have been beautiful scientific experiments that show this kind of information, that the light source that comes from the galactic centers is an unstoppable creative force, and it creates life everywhere it goes, everywhere it touches, and when life can exist, it will form and will be created as a result of this galactic, the great sun in the center of the galaxy. And it seems that our sun, the closest star to us, our sun, is the conduit of this life source and light source that we get. And you know, this stuff gets really entangled. And that's why it's called entanglement, the quantum soup of infinite possibility. And, you know, it's not accidental that God said, let there be light in Genesis 3. These things are deeply encoded in this numeric code, the cosmic numeric code. And I want to come back to life after death. Okay, people stop worrying about death. The worst thing that can happen to you is you can die. Okay, personally, I look forward to the day that I die because I'm looking forward to what happens afterwards. But
let's not rush it, Mike, yeah. Right?
But stop being afraid of death. Remember, the first thing we get taught in physics, and I'm not promoting the concept that physics has all the answers. They don't have all the answers. But the first thing we get taught is that you cannot destroy energy. Energy is permeates the whole of the universe, and that's why it's laughable that we have to pay for electricity. You know, on the one hand, they tell us the energy is everywhere, and then they charge you for it. Okay, that there's a con in there already. You can see that immediately. But our bodies are just energy forms that inhabit this thing called consciousness, our souls, which are an expression of an eternal, the divine creative source of consciousness that manifests itself in this weird thing we call reality. I tell you, this stuff gets really important. It's entangled. It's fascinating. But unfortunately, I don't think we got enough time to go into this. But what I can tell you, all of the stuff you're talking about is directly linked to the ancient civilizations of Southern Africa. The gold mining, why they needed the gold, because it is not about the gold in its diatomic state, the shiny metal. It's all about the gold in its monoatomic form that elevates
right.
you to higher
that's
frequencies.
Important. Yeah. That's important. Let's go to Dell, West Los Angeles. There you go, Dell. Thanks for holding.
Oh, you're welcome, George. Enjoying this. Hey, Michael, you're talking about that gold over there in South Africa. Is that energy that's over there? Is the gold causing that? You know, from those gods that are transmitting their energy? Could that be happening that way?
I don't think so. I think the gold is definitely in the ore, in the ground, as they refer to in the Sumerian tablets, in the veins in the ground, right? But the stone circles were certainly energy devices that were used for the extraction and the separation and the purification of the gold. But it probably wasn't done in the way that we do it today. If you've been to a gold mine or any mine that extracts metals, you'll see how primitive the process is. It's ridiculous. It's like we're living in the Stone Age, right? When we got frequency and energies with frequencies that can separate all these metals and minerals, just like a certain frequency separates oil from water. That's why when they talk about oil spills being disasters, well, certain frequencies will solve that oil pollution on oceans in a few seconds. They completely separate the materials from each other. And the same goes for the separation of gold from other metals in the ground. And so the energies in the circles was for everything they did, for the mining purposes, for heat, for levitation, for light, for whatever you can imagine. They used those energy devices that they created in the shape of the stone circles.
You know, Michael, you know, as we look at what has gone on in the past, what really fascinates me more than just anything we've done is the fact that the stories of these origins gets handed down, gets written down, put on tablets or in the Bible, wherever it might be.
Yeah.
The storytellers of the ages, that's a fascinating topic all by itself, isn't it?
Oh, my God, that absolutely, George. And somebody actually mentioned it earlier tonight at my presentation here in Sacramento, said that it's amazing, if you think about what you've just said, the accuracy with which these stories have been passed down from civilization to civilization. And you see that accuracy in the Sumerian tablets, in the translations of the Sumerian tablets. That's fascinating. And you know that these kings lists that you find in the Sumerian tablets. And if ever there was a body of evidence that tells us that we're dealing with accurate information comes to us from the king's list, or at least two of them that I've looked at and studied, where you get exactly the same information. Now, I use a thing called probability in my scientific evaluation of these things, and probability is a very well accepted scientific argument. And when you start applying probability in some of these cases and research, it blows your mind because we're dealing with factual things that cannot have been fabricated.
Fascinating guest, Michael. Good luck with your work, Adam's Calendar. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.